signature moment of the rise of the manosphere was last year in November when Trump was re-elected president of the United States, and a tweet by the far-right, open, white nationalist, kind of fascist Nick Fuentes went viral, "Your body, my choice." This kind of sick, twisted mirror inversion of the famous, you know, women's liberation slogan, "My body, my choice," in support of reproductive rights, distorted by this fascist figure of the manosphere to say that, you know, the election of Trump signaled, you know, the victory and the insurgency of the far-right misogynistic movement. And it was, you know, taken up with gusto by, you know, other figures of the far-right manosphere, but also at the grassroots level, young boys and young men who have been radicalized by this politics of extreme sexism and misogyny, chanting it in classrooms, chanting it in colleges, and, you know, creating an atmosphere of intimidation and vicious sexism at the grassroots level towards women. And obviously, I think it's a bit of a signal of the relationship between the kind of manosphere, kind of culture warriors, YouTubers, podcasters, etc., the grassroots where this is impacting attitudes amongst young men, but also marching into the halls of the establishment with figures like Donald Trump and the victory of overturning Roe v. Wade and abolishing the reproductive rights of tens of millions of women and people across America. So we're obviously living through an intense sexist backlash in mass culture, and social media we see is plastered with extreme misogynistic ideas and hyper-commodified images of women's bodies. And attitudes about gender roles are getting much, much worse, particularly among boys and young men. So one study, for example, of Australian attitudes about gender from last year at the International Women's Day annual Ipsos surgery showed that Gen Z and millennials are more likely than Gen X and baby boomers to think that a man who stays home to look after his children is like less of a man. So, you know, it's kind of bucking the trend generally of like young people having more progressive attitudes. There's a polarization, and a subsection of young men have adopted even more extremely misogynistic attitudes than kind of, yeah, men on the right, baby boomers, etc. 6 in 10 in the survey, 60% of Gen Z men said that agreed with the statement, "We have gone so far in promoting women's equality that we are discriminating against men." So this is seriously concerning, the impact that the manosphere is having on like mass attitudes globally. And this is true in Australia. Probably worth saying it's not as extreme in Australia as it is in the US and the UK. Important for us to give us heart and our capacity to challenge that, but this is a feature globally. And this misogyny is driving recruitment to a growing far right and fascist right. At the heart of this sexist backlash, of course, is the manosphere, the social media influencers, self-help grifters, and far right activists who are driving a reactionary culture war against the limited gains of the women's movement of the 20th century. So the grifters of the manosphere are more likely to make millions of dollars selling their sad sack followers supplements and poorly written self-help books, running crypto scams and sex trafficking Ponzi schemes, then going directly into politics. But the manosphere, I think, really should be understood as part of the growth of far-right movements and far-right and fascist political parties globally, albeit a distinct subsection of this far-right. So figures like Andrew Tate promote a perverted fantasy of male supremacy and hyper-capitalist competition, a world where alpha men become millionaires by sexually exploiting multiple female partners and physically dominating weaker men. So the problems of both individuals and society are blamed on a retreat from supposedly natural gender hierarchies that are threatening the foundations of Western civilization. So these YouTubers, podcasters, and social media influencers that make up the manosphere are a product of and are feeding back into a wave of reactionary politics that I would argue has emerged out of a crisis of neoliberal capitalism. So the manosphere is making society more unequal, exploitative, and abusive for girls and women. It's radicalizing a layer of boys and young men into a pipeline of far-right politics. And the main beneficiaries of this movement, besides sick individuals like Andrew Tate, who've kind of made themselves multimillionaires off the back of this, are the far-right political parties, which are able to drive support in a climate of reactionary politics which the manosphere contributes to, and try and sell the lies that, rather than the 1% being responsible for growing inequality and societal problems, you know, punching down at minorities and women. So to smash the manosphere, we have to confront both their reactionary ideas, but also the material conditions that they emerge from, the exploitation and structural sexism of capitalism, and in particular, the rampant inequality and ideological chaos of modern capitalism in the wake of neoliberalism. So I want to talk about, in this talk, where the manosphere emerged from and some of its key ideas, how capitalist crisis has fueled the far right, why pro-capitalist liberal feminism, I would argue, and social democracy are not up to the task of confronting the manosphere, and what kind of class-based solidarity and anti-capitalist politics is needed to smash this sexist reactionary movement. So the manosphere is a loose network of deeply incoherent and often contradictory currents. So I think if you look at first glance, like incel terrorists, evangelical Christian extremists, Andrew Tate's online grooming courses, these could all seem like quite incoherent and contradictory, counterposed currents of thought. Yet they converge on the same underlying worldview and intensified form of the sexist ideology that already underpins capitalist society. So they promote the belief that Western civilization depends on rigidly enforced gender roles and a natural social hierarchy. So also just accepting and celebrating capitalist exploitation, competition, and the ruthless struggle to get to the top of that. So they insist that this order has been upended by a cultural Marxist and feminist conspiracy, one that has now emasculated men, and now men are oppressed in modern society. So the modern manosphere traces its roots in the men's rights movement, pickup artist subculture, and new atheist circles of the 1990s and early 2000s. These online communities of men range from apolitical advice on how to manipulate women into bed or sexually assault women, to divorced fathers whinging about custody battles, to Islamophobic Richard Dawkins fans complaining about political correctness, making it hard for them to make rape jokes and Islamophobic comments. But in the post-global financial crisis world, these subcultures began to radicalize and expand in their influence and their support base. So the most extreme wing of this, the incel, involuntary celibates community, emerged as a breakaway from pickup artist forums, attracting alienated and socially isolated young men who developed the most extreme forms of misogynist ideology. So these online incel communities have inspired several mass murders, most notably the 2014 Isla Vista attack, which left 6 people dead at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And to give you a bit of a sense of the misogynistic ideology that underpinned these mass murders, the killer published an incel manifesto, he targeted women, and left behind a phone containing a video of himself crying about 2 women not saying hello to him. In one video, he declared he had no choice but to exact revenge on the society that had denied him sex. And his search history included the question, did Adolf Hitler have a girlfriend? So you can see the very real connections between this male entitlement to women's bodies, a developing misogynistic ideology, and actually fascist connections to it. So also in 2014 came Gamergate, a viral campaign of sexist harassment targeting women in the gaming industry. So many future manosphere figures cut their teeth in the conspiracy theories and online mobs that emerged in 4chan, 8chan, and Reddit during this period. One of them, do people remember Milo Yiannopoulos? He's kind of old news these days, yeah. Socialist Alternative played a big role in protesting him when he was on tour here back in, I think, 2017. He built his brand as an openly homophobic gay man who was a supporter of Trump, and he rode a wave of notoriety in the kind of Gamergate online harassment mobs, launching a global speaking tour devoted to the message that feminism is cancer. So Gamergate, I think, is an interesting case because it's on the surface kind of sub-political, but it's become something of a model for the way that the online operate these culture wars. So it's a precursor to the kind of backlash against mass culture that seemed to be like inclusive and promoting diversity, the kind of go woke, go broke movements of the modern era. And it's a bit of an indicator of like the grievances that the manosphere can build on. Gaming was previously a male-dominated industry and also culture, But as women made inroads both into the industry, but also in, as consumers within the gaming industry, gaming industry is like capitalist, it's interested in promoting itself also to women and more diverse audiences on a purely self-interested basis. But there's this kind of pushback against that by reactionary men who see this as an incursion into like their culture. So in 2016, Donald Trump's election turbocharged this pre-existing sexist right. Fascist groups like the Proud Boys gained prominence. The Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, where the leftist Heather Heyer was murdered, brought overt white nationalism into the spotlight. And Proud Boys, it's sort of in their name, the Proud Boys. They connected the question of traditional masculinity being under siege to Western civilization being under siege. So a more explicit connection between the misogynistic ideas and the explicit organizing of the fascist right. So in the early Trump years, Jordan Peterson also emerged as a movement's most effective gateway to a broader audience. So more than any figure before him, Peterson gave bigotry a pseudo-intellectual gloss. His bestseller, 12 Rules for Life, blended two key ingredients of the manosphere. First, a brand of self-help for men built on so-called hard truths about discipline and fortitude, make your bed, sit up straight, all those banalities. And second, a plausible deniability couched in an ambiguous relationship to the fascist and far right that allowed him to straddle mainstream respectability and extremist appeal. So Peterson first went viral as a self-styled free speech warrior, refusing to use the preferred pronouns of his trans students at the University of Toronto. But perhaps his most infamous piece of pop pseudoscience was a claim that natural hierarchies in lobster pods serve as a pre-cultural prototype for human society. So lobsters have hierarchies, humans have hierarchies, it's all natural, baby. And if you attempt to overturn the natural hierarchies of the capitalist order, which apparently have always existed, that's actually tyranny, not the actual hierarchies themselves. And I'll say a little bit more later about the manosphere's love of evolutionary psychology, but I'll leave that for now. So in the 2010s, videos of Peterson destroying feminist BBC interviewers went viral. He promoted the idea that the gender pay gap was a myth and a lie, and he sympathised openly with male high school shooters. So in some ways, the manosphere of today has shed the plausible deniability of the Peterson era. It's kind of come out into the open, doesn't have to kind of hide behind that kind of ambiguity. Isn't now openly reveling in the glorification of male dominance, sexual control of women, and gendered violence. So the Tate brothers, I'm sure everybody here doesn't need to know their whole history, we're people familiar with them, but they openly celebrate violence against women, are self-described misogynists, and have made a business out of teaching men how to sexually exploit women for financial gain. So Tate's a former kickboxer who shot to fame from his appearance and then eviction from the Big Brother house. He's currently facing charges of human trafficking in Romania and multiple counts of rape in the UK. And he effectively ran a sexual exploitation Ponzi scheme, so Hustlers University, where young men could be taught how to make a passive income by coercing multiple female partners into doing cam girl sex work. And he ran and sold and made millions off what he called his PhD, his pimping hoes degree. This is the kind of sick language and business model of these far-right hustlers. And it's worth saying something about Tate's now open connections to the far-right political parties, like the reason that Tate is in Florida right now. It's kind of like an open secret that the Trump administration lobbied the Romanian government to allow him, while the court case continues, to live in the United States of America. And more and more, Reform UK, the far-right political party, is flirting with Tate and trying to build off some of his base as well. So I want to briefly mention as well Tradwives, which I guess is technically not part of the manosphere, but I think is importantly runs parallel to it. So these influences promote an appalling caricature of middle-class 1950s housewives and colonial-era homestead cosplayers, so churning butter, serving their hubbies, and staying perpetually barefoot and pregnant, while documenting a totally fake and unattainable lifestyle on Instagram and other social media platforms. And I think they're worth mentioning for a couple of reasons. So one, women can be sexist too, and they're actually a growing part of the far right, particularly in the United States. And this is because the key divide on this question is class and politics, not gender. So plenty of sexist women are part of the MAGA and the far MAGA movement and the far right, and because of their class position as overwhelmingly rich women, often capitalist or aspiring capitalist influences, they benefit from a sexist system. So one example of that is Hannah Neeleman, aka Ballerina Farm, who is the wife of the heir to the JetBlue fortune, Daniel Neeleman. So, you know, presenting this kind of image of like having, you know, lots of children and, you know, spending all the time churning butter and for some reason making a bunch of shit from scratch that obviously the overwhelming majority of women couldn't do even if we wanted to. I couldn't understand why you would. And some, like Isla Stewart, openly promote fascist conspiracy theories, including the Great Replacement Theory. So Stewart courted controversy when her white baby challenge, so you've heard of the ice bucket challenge, she had a white baby challenge, went viral after she declared, as a mother of six, I challenge families to have as many white babies as I have contributed. So you really see how this like vision of a reactionary picture of women's role in the household, you know, out of work, back into the household, having lots of babies, is also connected to basically a white America vision of Trump society on the far right of the Republican Party. Okay, so there's been a lot of attention on the role of social media in the rise of the manosphere, and this is certainly part of the picture. So YouTube, Twitter, X, Reddit, and TikTok are all major corporations which make billions of dollars on an attention economy, which is often served by promoting a controversial, sensational, and contrarian content. And you just have to look at the attitudes of Silicon Valley psychos like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk to see their sympathy for the manosphere. And social media platforms promote a hyper-individualist culture that is built on the cultivation of a personal brand and its commodification. So influencers are effectively small business-owning micro-celebrities. Regardless of their politics or their success, these petty bourgeois or little capitalists are driven to produce content that is most successful on an algorithm set by a for-profit social media giants. So anyone who follows, for example, Palestinian journalists or quite popular left-wing pages will know that there's nothing democratic about the marketplace of ideas that exists on social media. So even quite popular left-wing accounts on social media are subject to things like shadow bans. That, you know, so there's nothing, it's not just like, oh, people vote with their feet and that's the thing that gets popular on social media. These things are reinforced by an algorithm set by a for-profit corporation that has an interest in suppressing some things and promoting other things. But really, I think too much focus is placed on the current trends in social media platforms. It's not unimportant, but I think it can be a distraction from the things that we actually can challenge, which is not how X sets its algorithm. So before it was Tate on TikTok, it was incels on Reddit or new atheists on message boards. What is more essential for the socialist left is an understanding of the economic and political context that the manosphere has risen out of, the crisis of neoliberal capitalism. So neoliberalism promised prosperity, yet from the boom years of the 1990s to the brink of 2008, inequality kept rising. But the narrative was that a rising tide would lift all boats. And then when the global financial crisis hit in 2007, 2008, this myth collapsed. And the result of that has been an avalanche of disillusionment and political polarization. So institutions like the IMF, the World Bank, the UN, the EU, once sold to us as neutral institutions, were exposed as enforcers of the same of the global elite. And this has led, importantly, to radicalization on the left, which we celebrate and is an important part of fighting back against capitalism, but also political polarization on the right. So in this era, mainstream parties of the left and right, which had converged in the center, started to collapse in popularity for their role in managing austerity. So the pillars of neoliberal ideology also started to crumble. Trickle-down economics, the myth of an ever-upward march of progress, the fantasy of a post-racial West, and the corporate-friendly lean-in feminism that promised empowerment without challenging power. So in the vacuum, people looked for political alternatives, and like I said, initially disillusionment swung overwhelmingly to the left, people wanting to fight the rich and powerful as opposed to punch down and blame women and minorities. But the failure of political projects like Syriza, Podemos, Corbynism in the first time round led to a space that I think in the wake of those failures, the far right has more and more filled. So these projects were defeated, absorbed, and demoralized. So the far right emerged and claimed the outsider mantle, railing against the corporate establishment while defending the very hierarchies that capitalism depends on. And that was in this climate that the manosphere has flourished, selling reactionary nostalgia as rebellion and turning discontent into fuel for a hard right culture war. So the manosphere takes the common sense ideas of gender roles that are embedded into the capitalist structures of society and pushes them to extremes, saying women's primary purpose in this worldview is to serve as obedient wives and devoted mothers. So in this worldview, billionaires aren't the problem, they're the aspiration. That's what, you know, all the Maseratis of the Tate brothers, that's what we're told, what men are told to aspire to. And society is framed as a ruthless competition in which men must grind, lift, and grift their way to millionaire status. So the manosphere sells a 1950s fantasy of the nuclear family with the father as the household's little king. In reality, this ideal has rarely existed in reality for most working class people, and today it is further out of reach than ever. So young men are still socialized to expect the role of breadwinner, the central financial provider and husband at the head of a stable family. Yet the single income household has always been more of a myth than a reality for working class families. Overwhelmingly in history, working class families, women worked. And under neoliberal capitalism, even this illusion is crumbling. So some shifts in household structures reflect progressive changes in attitudes and the improved economic position of women. So falling marriage rates, good. Delayed parenthood, good. And smaller families, all a sign of women having greater autonomy and control over their bodies and their reproduction. But these changes also coincide with rising inequality that locks many people, both men and women, out of lifestyles they do want that their parents and grandparents had. So soaring housing costs keep young people living with their parents or in shared accommodation longer, while home ownership is less attainable than at any point in living memory. So the economic foundations that supposedly supported the traditional family are being eroded, not by feminism or cultural Marxism or cultural change at all, but by the structural pressures of capitalism itself. So the manosphere taps into these real structural changes and fans the flame of the myth of male grievance, directing it at women and at the symbols of social progress. So a left-wing response to this would be to defend women's right to autonomy while organising workers to fight for their living standards, challenging housing affordability, fighting for free universal childcare, higher wages for both men and women against the gender pay gap, and social programs that would win back some of the standards of living eroded by decades of the neoliberal onslaught. So I want to say something about the supposed epidemic of male loneliness that we are told is fueling misogyny. And I think a lot of liberal commentary concedes far too much to this point. Instead of focusing on fighting sexism, it focuses on the concerns of men and how society can template healthy masculinity. So mental health services are obviously totally fucked, and you only have to look at the crisis of the New South Wales mental health sector to see that. It's a joke. But this talk about male loneliness is not a sincere response to a crisis of mental health services at all. It's a stalking horse for promoting male grievance and whitewashing antisocial and sexist behaviour. And it's pretty obvious, like all of these far-right grifters, they don't give a shit if mental health, like public services are closed. This is not part of their agenda at all. Talking about things like male loneliness and suicide rates and that kind of thing is literally just a kind of a bait and switch to try and say that men are now the oppressed ones in society. They have actual serious solutions to these problems. Okay. So much of the manosphere content is about denying the reality of women's oppression and instead painting men as the victims of a society that has taken women's rights too far. Manosphere commentators like to pick out statistics which show worse or declining results for men and boys to illustrate that men are now oppressed. For example, Richard Reeves, who's kind of adjacent to and popular with the manosphere, if not a figure of it himself, his book of Boys and Men, has been taken up by many manosphere commentators. And he points out things that are true, like men's real wages have declined by 14% in the United States since 1979, while women's wages, relative to where they were, have grown. Labour force participation by working age men has declined, with 9 million prime working age men not in the labour force even prior to COVID-19. And boys underperform in schools and are attending university at rates lower than women. But despite all of these shifts, women are still paid systematically less than men in every single industry internally and in industries that they dominate. The gender pay gap persists across and within industries. And while the statistics about wage decline and unemployment actually demonstrate is a one-sided class war waged by the rich, by the bosses, a class war which hurts both women and male workers, even if the better paid once unionised jobs in male-dominated industries have been hit worse by this process. I think the only way that you can respond to these points is by actually putting forward a socialist vision that challenges the sexist underlying assumptions, but also does have answers to the attacks on working class living standards. So most of the time, the grievances that the Manosphere talk about are not class questions deflected by sexism, but just totally made up bullshit. So angry divorced dads rage against their ex-wives getting custody and child support, romantically unsuccessful men who think that they're entitled to sex, and they have a whole cottage industry of pseudoscience to give intellectual weight to their bigotry. And I want to talk a bit about evolutionary psychology and how dominant this has become in the Manosphere. So in my opinion, the entire field of evolutionary psychology should probably be taken with a very, very heavy dose of skepticism. For its reductionism, its deterministic and mechanical thinking, and its habit of projecting existing social norms onto, like, nature. But even if you think evolutionary psychology does have some interesting and legitimate insights, its use by the Manosphere is total garbage science, on par with, like, the social Darwinism and phrenology of the 19th century. So Manosphere influencers have peddled a steady stream of the pseudoscience to justify their misogyny, not just Peterson's lobsters, the alpha-beta wolf myth that has now trickled into the mainstream as a way of framing male competition for partners and for status. Another favourite comes from the studies of birds like the collared flycatcher and its extra-pair mating behaviour. This has been twisted into the claim that women are biologically hardwired to cheat on their partners. And one Manosphere blogger even declared that over millions of years of natural selection, they've weeded out the faithful women through this female dating strategy. Well, I want to move on to talking about the solutions to all this garbage. So, and some of the responses that exist to the Manosphere. So if we want to smash the Manosphere, we need to have the right politics and strategy to fight it. And it's not just the anti-capitalist left that is concerned about the rise of extreme misogyny. So the dominant response is a centrist response to the Manosphere, whether from politicians like Keir Starmer or columnists in The Guardian. And the dominant response is to frame the Manosphere as a law and order question, a question of the state and law and order problem. And their solution is more discipline in schools, harsher prison centres, taking kids' phones off them in school, kicking kids off social media, young people off social media, more funding to the cops and to anti-terrorist programs like Prevent, which are much more likely to dob in someone supporting Palestine Action in the UK than they are like some incel freak. So these centrist liberals defend the status quo, treating the Manosphere as a threat to social cohesion and individual safety, while quietly accepting a lot of the major premises of the Manosphere. So while they acknowledge the high-profile influencers like Andrew Tate, their real focus is on the grassroots of the Manosphere, especially school-age boys. And they zero in, I think, on street-level sexism, which obviously is a real concern, but why the centrists kind of focus on this instead of on the top-down drive of the Manosphere, the multimillionaires and politicians and extremely influential people at the top of this movement, they zero in on street-level sexism while avoiding these far-right politics because they want to constantly capitulate to this far-right politics. And you can see this all around the world. I want to talk about the British TV show Adolescence. Who has watched it? Yeah, it's like, you know, good acting and stuff, that's good. But one shot camera, wow, cool. But I think it actually is a good example of this kind of Keir Starmer centrist law and order response. There's very little explicit reference to Andrew Tate. There's very little explicit reference to like the experience of sexism by women and young girls. Like, it's very little in the show. If you remember the episode where they like go into the school is like a jungle of chaos and the teachers are all kind of clueless or incompetent or don't care. I've never met a teacher like that in my life. And then the episode in the cop shot is like professional and seamless and he's kind of booked in and they're like ready to get to the truth or whatever, which is just like, I think Keir Starmer could have written this thing. And the kind of response of it, while acknowledging the problem, all of the response of it is that this is just a question of law and order, not a question of actually challenging like sexism, the conditions of women overall, and also the rise of the far right. And this is coming from the kind of figures like Keir Starmer, who, like, to give an example of their capitulation to the far right, Starmer is openly echoing the far right's anti-migrant politics right now, you know, talking about Britain becoming an island of strangers because of mass migration. These figures and their response is not going to lead to any serious response to the far right. Okay. So centrism cannot respond to the manosphere, accepts the framework of the institutions and structures of capitalism, which are responsible for rising sexism and inequality, so it can't provide a class-based response to far-right propaganda. And I think if you watch videos of liberal feminist journalists debating Jordan Peterson, it's striking also how few of them are capable of calling out Jordan Peterson's bullshit. The kind of dominant, lean-in, pro-capitalist feminism is quite disarmed by a bunch of these arguments, even if they can recognise the problem. And I think a big reason is that their politics reflects the experience of professional middle class or even ruling class women accepting the fundamentals of capitalism while opposing only the unequal opportunities women like themselves face within that system. So one viral YouTube clip shows Peterson destroying a BBC journalist and self-described feminist. And to be honest, like, she lands very few blows in this video. And I think when it's clear why this is, when the topic turns to the gender pay gap, her starting point is the conditions of women in the top 1%. So she just talks about like FTSE 500, how there's only 7 women CEOs. This is like her response to him talking about the pay gap that exists like 50% of the population. Let's start right at the multimillionaires. And Peterson argues that the pursuit of gender equality is not just alienating for men, it's bad for women. And in response, he can point to some real instances of economic disadvantages towards women that appear to back up his arguments. So for example, the often quoted rise in poverty for divorced women. And so the far right can say, oh, well, this is an example why women were sold a lie about feminism. Your economic standards are worse, you know, more likely to be homeless and poor if you get a divorce. So obviously these are cynical, totally cynical arguments coming from Peterson, but I think that pro-capitalist choice feminism is totally disarmed by them. So older divorced women are one of the fastest growing demographics of homeless people in this country and many countries around the world, and that's a problem of class inequality and sexism. And that issue is worlds apart from the experience of professional middle class women at the BBC or Fortune 500 CEOs. And they're also similarly, you know, disarmed with these arguments about the gender pay gap when they constantly focus on professional women at the top, and this idea that women just choose lower paid jobs instead of looking at the systemic exploitation and oppression of women, women-dominated industries. Okay. But today the dominant framework on the left for understanding oppression is identity politics, and I wanted to speak a bit about why this is disarming as well. So identity politics is just as incapable of mounting a fight back against the manosphere, in my opinion, as liberal feminism. And one reason is that it accepts the idea that ordinary working class men have a stake in keeping sexism alive. And that the only way they'll reject sexism is by giving up their privileges. And on the surface, this sounds like the opposite of the manosphere's message, but I think it actually shares many of the same underlying premises. So manosphere grifters tell working class men that feminists, progressives, and socialists are coming to take away their privileges. And identity politics says, yes, we are. And both see society as a power struggle between different identities hopelessly divided by interlocking systems of oppression instead of a class struggle where workers are divided from with bosses. But I would argue we don't need allies checking their privilege. We need comrades fighting together to win better rights for workers and the liberation of humanity. Working class men gain nothing in following the cranks and grifters of the manosphere. And a struggle for women's social and political equality comes at the expense of billionaires, not at the expense of any group of workers. So socialists argue that working class men can be won to an anti-sexist politics because they're exploited by the same capitalist system that exploits and oppresses women. And that is not to say that working class men cannot buy into the sexist ideology of the manosphere. They absolutely can and have, and many of them have. But socialists argue that these ideologies, like anti-migrant politics that the far right are also pushing, is a lie. And when workers buy into these ideologies, they're going against their own class interests. Racist and sexist culture wars stop us from confronting our real enemies. Well, I'm starting to run out of time, but I wanted to just quickly say something about social democracy as well. I think there is a rise of, you know, social democrats that are also wanting to deal with the question of the manosphere, kind of Jacobin magazine type Corbyn world, so like kind of democratic socialist left in Britain. And I think they would probably agree with a lot of the critiques that I've made of liberal feminism and identity politics. But I think that they cede too much to the manosphere and into this idea that we have to relate to the alienation of like boys and young men of the far right. I think that's bullshit. There's never been a history where like the way you confront the far right is to sympathize with any of their grievances. This kind of approach, I think, has almost nothing to say to like the girls and young women experiencing the rise of this extreme sexist ideology. So we need a socialist movement that is stridently anti-sexist, that confronts the reactionary politics of the manosphere, but raises class struggle as the alternative. So there are no shortcuts. Smashing the manosphere means building a mass socialist left rooted in the working class. And I think some of the greatest advances in women's rights and in social attitudes towards women came during the high points of class struggle, and that's particularly true in this country. So in the late 60s and the early 70s, the left of the workers' movement was animated by the politics of solidarity and socialism. Male-dominated unions like metal workers fought for and won equal pay and were actually the cutting edge of that struggle because of their socialist politics. And to them, it was obvious. A win for women workers was a win for all workers, and not just on the questions of pay that affect all workers, but also on the particular political rights of women, like reproductive rights. So the working class phrase, touch one, touch all, animated this movement. So in the 70s, for example, the Builders Labourers Federation, a union dominated by communists, socialists, Labour leftists, fought against the sexist New South Wales construction bosses to push women into the construction industry, into well-paid jobs. And that is the kind of movement that we should aspire to, I think, today. And they were impacted by the politics of the Women's Liberation Movement, and many of the Women's Liberation Movement actually got jobs in the construction industry in relationship with this union. So this wave of strikes and social movements broke through the stultifying sexist conservatism of the 1950s and 1960s and raised the consciousness of a generation of workers. Class struggle and solidarity can push the reactionary politics of the misogynistic right back into the gutter that it came out of, but reactionary ideas will always find fertile ground as long as capitalism survives. So gender roles feel natural under capitalism because they're built into the structures of society. Women are valued less because they are actually paid less. and the family unit, an essential prop of capitalism, relies on women's unpaid labours. So these are the structures that can't be reformed out of existence. They have to be overturned through revolution. I think that is the vision that we have to have in fighting against the immediate threat of the manosphere. And I'll leave it there.